Good evening, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here this evening, and particularly to welcome our very distinguished guest, Antonio Cassese. Professor Cassese says he wants to speak for a long time, so he made me give a very brief introduction. It's also because he's extremely modest, and he didn't want to raise expectations too high. So this is an extremely truncated introduction. He is currently Professor of International Law at Florence University. From November 1993 to January 2000, he served as President and Judge at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and was presiding judge of the Appeals Chamber of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda from 1994 to 1997. He also served as member and president of the Council of Europe Committee for the Prevention of Torture from 1989 to 1993. I'm very pleased to say that I played a very minor but significant role in Professor Cassese's fame in the English-speaking world because before I came to the LSE, I used to be one of the people who worked for a publishing firm. And we were the first to translate Professor Cassese's works into English. And that firm has now translated no less than four of his major books into the English language. This lecture marks the inauguration of a new master's course in human rights starting at the LSE. We would like to develop a major initiative around the theme of human rights at the school, not only because it's an important conjuncture in the development of criminal law today, but because we think the LSE is the place which should take a special interest in the field of human rights. So this is an important lecture for more than one reason for us. The title of Professor Cassese's lecture is International Criminal Justice. Is it really so needed in the present world community? To which I hope the answer will be yes, Professor Cassese.
Now, for the sake of clarity, I shall try to set forth my principal argument at the outset. My argument is as follows. In the world today, we witness, on the one hand, the spread of violence and gross violations of human rights, and on the other, a deep crisis in the international means of effectively reacting to those gross violations. Enforcement by the UN Security Council and other UN bodies is in deep trouble. In addition, states hesitate to take unilateral peaceful sanctions against the offenders unless states are motivated by some ulterior motive, such as self-interest. This legal vacuum is being filled by resorting to a number of fallback mechanisms and devices. However, the one that has proved to be by far the most effective sanction is the prosecution and punishment by either national or international criminal tribunals of those accused of perpetrating gross violations. Now, to grasp the profound significance that criminal justice, and in particular that dispensed by international courts, has in the present world community, I think it is necessary to place it in its general context. You will therefore allow me to outline briefly some essential conditions of the international community, which to my mind constitute the context in which criminal justice must be appraised. One of the striking features of the current world community is the failure of the collective bodies that are charged with enforcing international law to discharge their function. In recent years, the UN Security Council has proved to be unable to solve major international crises. it has become a truism that after the demise of Cold War, or the Cold War, the growing disparities between rich and poor, increasing poverty and hopelessness, as well as nationalism, religious fundamentalism, and ethnic and religious hatred have spawned violence, ethnic cleansing, and a lot of bloodshed. We all know that internal armed conflicts have mushroomed. The Security Council has been unable to keep up with the staggering increase in violence. No one can contest, I think, its inability to react promptly and effectively and to put a stop to massacres amounting to serious threats to the peace, or to even breaches of the peace in Somalia, the former Yugoslavia, including Kosovo, Sierra Leone, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Indonesia, the Middle East, and so on. In addition, individual states as opposed to collective bodies such as the UN, have had scant, if any, resort to one particular legal weapon available to them as a response to gross violations of human rights, namely peaceful reprisals, what we technicians of international law currently term countermeasures, peaceful reprisals. Now, these countermeasures include such measures as economic sanctions, for instance, the suspension or termination of commercial treaties, trade embargoes, the freezing of or seizure of assets belonging to the foreign state, and so on. Why do states refrain from taking reprisals against gross violations of international law, in particular atrocities committed by other states? I think the reason is simple. States tend to resort to reprisals or countermeasures where their own interests are at stake, and other states have infringed upon those interests by breaching international law. In other words, states tend to react to the breach of reciprocal obligations by other states. In contrast, they incline to turn a deaf ear to breaches of international obligations protecting basic values, as the obligation not to threaten peace, not to engage in genocide, not to torture, not to discriminate racially, and so on. These last obligations are what I would call community obligations, as opposed to reciprocal obligations. They exhibit two basic features. First, they are incumbent upon each and every member of the world community towards all other members. Secondly, any other member of that community, of the international community, has a correlative right to demand fulfillment of those obligations, and in case of breach, has the right to resort to reprisals, peaceful reprisals or countermeasures. Plainly, the gross breaches of international law we are discussing are normally breaches of precisely such community obligations, not to commit genocide, not to torture, and so on. A strong reaction by states to those breaches presupposes the existence of a community interest to put a stop to them. However, the community interest in their fulfillment is still more potential than real. More potential than real. States still pursue short-term national interest rather than care about global human values, such as respect for human dignity, the duty not to torture, not to massacre, and so on. Hence, the disinclination of states to intervene to stop blatant infringements of community values. In other words, the community obligations that reflect a progress in the world community towards the Kantian model, what specialists in international relations call the Kantian model, are still only potential, whereas states tend to cling to the Grotian model, which is based on the idea of interstate relations. Faced with the problem of how to stem rampant violence in the world community, and given the failure of international collective or individual sanctions, a trend has gradually emerged to resort to a variety of fallback solutions. There are many mechanisms or devices or devices can be discerned. I will focus only on few of them for lack of time. First of all, in some countries, national courts can take over, in a way, the functions of governments and substitute themselves for the international enforcement agencies that either do not exist or have proved extremely ineffectual. Let me mention one of the first cases, which I think it's extremely important, is the famous Shimoda case. Shimoda was one of the survivors of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Together with other victims or members of the families of the victims of survivors of victims of the atomic bombing, they brought a case against the Japanese government in the Tokyo District Court. This is the Shimoda case. They claimed compensation from the Japanese government. They could not, for a lot of technical reasons I cannot dwell upon, they could not sue the American government. The court pronounced the bombing, the atomic bombing, illegal. And in this respect, it was really a breakthrough. For the first time, a judicial body said in so many words that atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a grave breach of international law, although in the final analysis, the court held against the complainants, again for technical legal reasons. In other cases, domestic courts have passed criminal judgment on individuals whom the territorial state had failed to prosecute. And we can think of the famous Eichmann case, which was brought before the District Court of Jerusalem and subsequently before the Supreme Court of Israel. And why? Because Germany or Argentina, where Eichmann was in hiding, failed to bring him to trial. However, it is the US, the country whose national courts have taken the most vigorous action against crimes committed abroad. The courts there in the US have taken down from the shelf and skillfully dusted off an old statute passed in 1789, the year of the French Revolution. This statute is the famous Alien Torts Claim Act, under which, and I quote, the US District Courts shall have original jurisdiction of any civil action by an alien for a tort only, a tort, committed in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the US, unquote. The US courts have applied this statute to gross violations of human rights perpetrated abroad by foreign state officials against their own nationals, thus obliging the culprits to pay compensation for those violations. Since 1980, US courts have in this way pronounced on torture in Paraguay, this is a celebrated case, the Filatiga case, torture by a Paraguayan police officer against a young man in Paraguay, political assassination ordered by Chilean authorities, the famous Letelier case, torture and racial discrimination for economic gain or arbitrary arrest and forced disappearance in Argentina, arbitrary killing in East Timor, torture, summary execution, and forced disappearances in the Philippines, the Marcos case, atrocities in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the Karadzic case, and so on. No one, I think, can deny the great significance of these US courts' decisions. In all these cases, US courts have vindicated rights pertaining to human dignity. In so doing, they have proclaimed in judicial decisions some fundamental human values. However, one should not be unmindful of the limits of this approach. First, these are civil cases where the alleged perpetrator of serious crimes is only ordered to pay compensation. No conviction is issued at the criminal level. In addition, the defendant is often abroad when the decision is issued and can therefore easily avoid paying compensation. The decision thus ends up having very often an exclusively symbolic value. Secondly, as these cases involving are cases involving civil litigation only, and as the defendant is normally absent, is abroad, no in-depth examination of the evidence takes place. Thirdly, this judicial trend has occurred in one country only, the US. There is a danger that the courts of this country will set themselves up as universal judges of atrocities committed abroad. This sort of humanitarian imperialism may give rise to concern. By itself, this might not be a problem if it not go hand in hand with the tendency of the US government to take upon itself the task of policing the world. The second trend we may discern in state practice to fill the vacuum left by international bodies is the lifting of international courts, by international courts, of the immunity from prosecution normally granted to senior state officials. And I will not go into these details because, of course, you are fully aware of the Pinochet case here in the House of Lords. The Pinochet case, which was followed recently in June and then in August of this year by an important judgment delivered by the Court of Appeal of Santiago in June, followed by a similarly important judgment delivered by the Chilean Constitutional Court in August. They have confirmed, the Chilean courts, that a former head of state cannot invoke immunity for ordering or planning torture. Similarly, last month, a French Court of Appeal held that Gaddafi could be prosecuted in France for acts of terrorism ordered in Libya, and actually has been accused of complicity in murder. The Quai d'Orsay, the foreign ministry, pointed out that Gaddafi is, although formally speaking, is not the head of state of Libya, he may be regarded as the supreme commander and the supreme political leader. However, the French Court of Appeal stated that he cannot enjoy immunity from prosecution for the alleged commission of complicity in genocide. However, again, there is resistance to this trend. Let me just mention in passing that in March of this year, the US State Department let an alleged Peruvian torturer, Mr. Anderson, to go free on the grounds that he enjoyed diplomatic immunity. He had been detained at Texas airport by FBI people at the request of the Ministry of Justice, but to my regret, the State Department decided that no, he did enjoy diplomatic immunity, so he was allowed to leave and go back to Peru. And this man, Major Anderson, a retired official of Peru's notorious Army Intelligence Service, had committed, according to the US State Department, horrendous crimes. Nevertheless, he was allowed to go back to Peru. So you see, there are quite a few problems in the application of this new rule whereby heads of states or senior state officials do not or may not enjoy immunity from prosecution for horrendous crimes such as war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. A further way of reacting to atrocities has been the resort to fact-finding followed by forgiveness. In other words, the establishment of truth and reconciliation commissions. It is common knowledge that these commissions, as established in many Latin American countries, Bolivia, Uruguay, Chile, El Salvador, Haiti, Argentina, and so on, have proved unable to bring about reconciliation. For at the most, they have identified the culprits, who, however, have been subsequently pardoned through amnesty laws. Even the much more fair and effective commission that established in South Africa in 1995 to deal with gross and politically motivated violations of human rights, to my mind, is far from having produced real reconciliation. As you know, it was empowered to grant amnesty to those who fully disclosed their crimes and possibly also testified on crimes perpetrated by others. In some cases, these persons were also obligated to pay compensation to their victims. Otherwise, the Commission recommended the criminal prosecution of those brought before it. However, although, of course, this South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission is by far more advanced and much better and more effective than the Latin American commissions, in many cases, this commission pardoned the authors of horrendous crimes, whether Afrikaners or members of the ANC, thus causing much resentment and anger among the victims or their relatives, who were instead very keen on retribution, on real justice. A fourth way of filling the gap left by international collective bodies and states can be found at the international level. It is the drafting of multilateral treaties concerning such matters as torture, terrorism. These are treaties which impose an obligation on the courts of any contracting state to exercise what we call universal jurisdiction over such crimes. These treaties, in other words, provide that the courts of each contracting state can and indeed must, there is an obligation, exercise jurisdiction over crimes perpetrated abroad when the alleged offender is on their territory. Say, if a crime has been committed in Italy and the alleged offender is in the UK, the British authorities have got to arrest him and bring him to trial. Otherwise, they can simply extradite this offender to the country where the crime is committed, say Italy. It is on the strength, as you all know, of one of these treaties, the Torture Convention of 1984, that in the Pinochet case, the House of Lords held that UK courts had jurisdiction over Pinochet's alleged crimes. And it is also by virtue of this same torture convention that the former Chadian dictator Hissène Habré was arrested and brought to trial in Senegal. He was in hiding in Senegal for the alleged torture of Chadians committed many years ago when he was a dictator in Chad. However, he was subsequently released, probably on political grounds. However, it is again on the basis of this 1984 torture convention that a Moroccan police officer has been recently prosecuted in France for the alleged torturer of his fellow nationals in Morocco. You see, it's a great advance in international law. A fifth way of substituting for international enforcement is the establishment of international criminal tribunals. And let me just simply mention that in 1993, the UN Security Council set up the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, followed by the next year, in 1994, by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. A few months ago, the Special Court for Sierra Leone has been, I would not say set up, because it has not yet been established, but was envisaged in an important treaty negotiated by Sierra Leone with the UN. And I gather from reliable sources that in late November, in a few weeks' time, the Cambodian parliament should pass a law setting up a quasi-international court in Cambodia for judgment, for passing judgment over the crimes of genocide committed by Pol Pot many years ago. After briefly describing the principal fallback solutions adopted at both national and international level, let me now try to focus on the merits of the judicial response to the commission of serious crimes in international law, because my purpose here today is to try to emphasize the importance of the judicial response to atrocities. I think that prosecution and punishment are better than resort to peaceful reprisals or countermeasures, because first, they target the culprits. not innocent persons, as in the case of reprisals. Think of the economic sanctions against Iraq, where the target is very often the civilian population. In the end, who suffers from those sanctions are not the leaders, the political and military leaders, but the civilian population. Instead, prosecution and punishment are intended to hit, in a way, the people who are presumed to be the real culprits. And secondly, prosecution and punishment of people who are responsible for serious crimes do not lend themselves to abuse, as reprisals do. So these are, to my mind, two major advantages. In addition, justice is better than forgetting. Forgetting through the granting of amnesties. You know, in many countries of the world, people tend to think, well, let us forget about the past crimes, for the sake of reconciliation, and give pardon to those who have allegedly committed horrendous crimes. It is prosecution and punishment is much better than simply letting crimes fall into oblivion. I think that forgetting beguiles future dictators or authoritarian leaders into relying on impunity. Impunity. I think impunity, this is what we must fight against. To bring alleged culprits to trial has, to my mind at least, the following merits. First, trials establish individual responsibility over the collective assignment of guilt. You can no longer say in the former Yugoslavia that all Serbs are guilty. This is not true. You can't say that all Croats, all Muslims are guilty. Only some members of any particular ethnic group are guilty, some people. And of course it is important not to criminalize the whole group, but only those who have perpetrated atrocities. Secondly, trials dissipate the call for revenge, because when the courts mete out the right punishment to the perpetrator, the victim's call for retribution is met. Thirdly, by dint of dispensation of justice, victims are prepared to be reconciled with their erstwhile tormentors, because they know that the latter have now paid for their misdeeds. And fourthly, this is not to be undervalued, a fully reliable record of atrocities is established so that future generations can remember and be made fully cognizant of what happened. If you read recent books, say, on Nazi crimes, you will see that most of them are based on judicial records. Even the most the book on willing executioners is totally by Hagenbacher is mostly based on judicial records he dug out in the archives in Germany. So it's very important for posterity to have this detailed record based on judicial evidence, so that people will not remember, will not forget. Now, given that prosecution and punishment of the alleged authors of heinous crimes may occur both at the national and international level, namely both before national or domestic criminal courts and before international criminal tribunals, we should now ask ourselves about the merits and weaknesses of these two responses. Is it better to go before national courts, or is it better or preferable to go before international tribunals? Now, to my mind, international tribunals enjoy a number of advantages over domestic courts, particularly those sitting in the territory of the state where atrocities have been committed. First of all, it is a fact that national courts are not inclined to institute proceedings for crimes that lack any territorial or national link with the state. In other words, national courts tend to try those who have committed a crime on the territory of the state, or those who have committed a crime against nationals of that state, or have the nationality of that state. We international lawyers speak in this regard of passive or active nationality or territoriality principle. National courts are still state-oriented and are loath to search for, prosecute and try foreigners who have committed crimes abroad against other foreigners. For them, the short-term objectives of national concern seem still to prevail. Secondly, international judges may be in a better position to be fully impartial, or at any rate more even-handed than national judges, who were caught up in the milieu in which the crime in question may have been perpetrated. The punishment of the alleged authors of international crimes by international tribunals normally meets with less resistance than national punishment, as it hurts national feelings much less. To me, this is very clear. If you hold a trial in The Hague, before the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, against Croats, judges are expected and normally are more impartial and independent than judges in Croatia, for obvious reasons. Thirdly, international courts can investigate crimes with ramifications in many countries more easily than national judges. Often the witnesses reside in different countries. In the former Yugoslavia, remember, we had in the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, we had to interview, the prosecutor, not we judges. The prosecutor had to interview witnesses who were far away, in Australia. They had people from, say, Bosnia or for Belgrade or for Zagreb, had gone to Australia as refugees. Some of them were in Australia, some of them were in the US. Some were in Germany and in many or in Africa, in African countries. So you have to send investigators to interview those people, and this is extremely complicated, of course, time-consuming and extremely expensive. So evidence needs to be collected thanks to the cooperation of several states before sending investigators to Australia, to the US, to Canada. Of course, you have to ask for permission from the national authorities. And in addition, special expertise is needed to handle the often tricky legal issues raised in the various national legislations involved. Fourthly, is the fourth merit, to my mind, of international criminal tribunals. Trials by international courts may ensure some sort of uniformity in the application of international law, whereas proceedings conducted before national courts may lead to a great disparity, both in the application of that law and also, and this is crucial, in the penalties given to those found guilty. And finally, the holding of international trials that are, by definition, more visible than national trials, signals, and this is, I think, important, signals the will of the international community to break with the past by punishing those who have deviated from acceptable standards of human behavior. In delivering punishment, the international community's purpose is not so much retribution. This was not our main concern in The Hague. Our main concern was stigmatization of the deviant behavior, in the hope that this will have a deterrent effect. I must add a small point. One of the big failures of international tribunals, but I will come back to this point in a few seconds, is precisely this lack of having a deterrent effect. But it was a hope. There is still hope to deter people from committing crimes in the future. Now, let me now move on to the many, numerous, grave problems besetting international trials. The crucial problem, clearly the key problem for international courts, is the lack of enforcement agencies. Now, a court here in London, can rely upon the police, what in continental Europe we call police judiciaire, namely that branch of police which is at the disposal of the prosecutor. So the prosecutor or the investigating judge in continental Europe, they have the police at their disposal, and they simply order the police to collect evidence, to arrest the suspect, to seize documents, to collect, I don't know, blood samples and so on. Now in The Hague and in Rwanda, in the Arusha, the Rwanda Tribunal, in the future Sierra Leone Tribunal, in the Cambodia Tribunal, you don't have a police, an enforcement agency at your disposal. You have a lot of investigators, you have prosecutors and so on, but if they want to collect evidence, they must go to Bosnia, they must go to Belgrade, they must go to Croatia, they must go to Australia, they must go to the US to interview witnesses, to collect evidence, and also, and this is crucial, to arrest people. Now, to go there, first of all, they can't arrest people. They can't go there without the permission of the national authorities. Why? Because the evidence, the suspect, the witnesses, the indictees are all on the territory of sovereign countries. So therefore, you can't, since you don't have a police which can is allowed to go there without permission of the sovereign state, you always have to go through the national authorities and ask for permission. If you want to collect evidence, and this has happened many times, say in Germany, in Italy, in the UK, you must ask, the prosecutor must ask the competent national authorities to come to London or to Rome or to Berlin. And of course, normally it is for the local authorities, for the local investigators, the judges, the prosecutors, to interview witnesses, may possibly with the investigators from The Hague, they are present, who may have the right to ask questions. So therefore, you see, you always need to go through national states, and state sovereignty is the big hurdle for the dispensation of criminal justice. Now, if countries, sovereign states, are not cooperative, you get stuck. Since, for instance, all the evidence which is available in the former Yugoslavia, I mean, in the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, in Belgrade, all the indictees who are there, they cannot be reached by the tribunal. The tribunal has asked, the prosecutor has asked a lot of time, the Belgrade authorities to hand over evidence. In the past, also this request was sent, say, to Croatia. Now Croatia has started to cooperate. But if the local authorities are reluctant or oppose any such request, they simply don't execute any arrest warrant or any other judicial order issued at the request of the Hague prosecutor by a judge in The Hague. So you are stuck. Sometimes I have said that these international tribunals are sort of giants who, however, because they are important, because they are a significant expressions of the present world community, but they lack their arms or legs, so they need some sort of artificial limbs to work and to walk, and the artificial limbs are the national prosecutorial authorities, are the national prosecutors and judges. If those judges don't give the artificial limb, the international tribunal is utterly impotent. This is the main problem. There is a second problem, which again is crucial and is becoming more and more serious, is the length of international criminal proceedings. Now, there are many reasons why international criminal proceedings are extremely long. Let me give you an example. Some people who have been arrested by NATO authorities or by the national authorities, for instance, in Croatia or in Bosnia-Herzegovina, have been put in jail in The Hague, and they have been in jail for 2 years before standing trial, and the trial may last up to 2 years. So 4 years in jail with the presumption of innocence. And at the end, he may be found innocent and acquitted. This has happened already in a few cases. Now, this is not fair, because you are presumed innocent, and you have to stay to be in jail. Now, you see, there are so many reasons. Probably I can't go into all these details. If you're interested in this particular matter, I can answer any questions, as I say, if you show any interest. Let me just give you an example. One reason is there are a few, many reasons. One reason is that at the international level, states have decided, the UN Security Council has decided to take up the accusatorial system. You know it because it is your system in the UK and other common law countries, based on examination, cross-examination, and so on. We don't have, however, have a jury. These are bench trials. We have three professional judges, no jury. However, for the rest of the trial, it's based on the accusatorial system. Now, that means that the proceedings are extremely protracted. Also, why? Because not only because you have to go through all the evidence, evidence for the prosecutor and the evidence for the defense, but also because, as you know, in your country and in other common law countries, this accusatorial system works because it is based on the assumption that most people will resort to the so-called pre-bargaining. Actually, I read somewhere that in the US, 80% of criminal cases are settled by through pre-bargaining. Only 20% of cases go before a court and have a full and they end up in fully fledged trials. Now, why? Because people are prepared to plead guilty and have a fairly lenient sentence. Now, this cannot happen at the international level. We had only two cases of people who pleaded guilty. Most people are not prepared to plead guilty. Why? Because of the stigma of the crimes attached to the crimes with which they are accused. These are crimes against humanity. Rape, massacres, genocide, killing of hundreds of civilians. Horrible. To be labeled war criminal is something really horrible, and they prefer, therefore, to go through the ordeal of a lengthy trial, to stay in jail before trial, even up to 2 years, instead of pleading guilty. So this is one of the other many problems. There are so many problems, for instance, language problems and so on. But what is also unique to international criminal trial is that we have, in a way, a combination of the bad side of the inquisitorial system, the one prevailing, as you know, in continental Europe, in civil law countries, and the accusatorial system. Now, in the accusatorial system, in the UK, in America and other countries, Australia, Canada, and so on, normally the defendant is free on bail. And then he is put in jail if he is found guilty and sentenced to imprisonment sentence. Whereas in continental Europe, normally he is in jail. Now, in The Hague and before other international criminal tribunals, we, as I said before, we have to follow the accusatorial system without, however, having the possibility of releasing the indictee before the beginning of the trial so that he can be free on bail. Why? Because if a man is arrested either by NATO forces or by the local authorities, and he's in our UN jail in the UN, nobody's prepared to guarantee that if he's released, he will not escape. When I was president, asked many times the Dutch authorities, could you please make sure that if he is released, he may stay in the Netherlands and come back to the court to stand trial, say, in 2 years' time, when we can start with his trial. I said, no, we can't do that. I'm so sorry. We are so sorry. He must be sent back to his country. Then you ask the authorities in his country. They say, well, we will try our best, but we can't guarantee that this man, if he goes into hiding, will then be arrested and come back to The Hague to stand trial. And of course, this applies a fortiori when this man has been arrested by NATO forces. He is most likely to go go in hiding. I now would like to, so you see all these problems besetting the international tribunals. I was planning, but I see that time is running out, I will try to skip some parts and deal with a few other criticisms which have been leveled at international criminal tribunals, in particular the tribunal which I know best, namely the Hague Tribunal. And I will mention some critical remarks made by a distinguished British lawyer, Mr. Geoffrey Robertson, QC, in his fascinating book on crimes against humanity, as well as criticisms leveled even recently by the Serbian authorities, including President Kostunica. Now, Mr. Robertson notes, first of all, that the establishment of the Hague Tribunal was a face-saving device for the impotence of great powers in 1993. There was no diplomatic or military solution available. As a fallback, they decided to set up the tribunal. I think he's right. It was a face-saving device. But my answer is that half a loaf is better than pie in the sky. So since now we have this tribunal, let us try to do what we can do with this tribunal. But his second point is that there is no complete separation of the prosecutorial from the judicial function. Why? He rightly points out that the Hague, if you go to the Hague and you see the big, horrible building where the tribunal is housed, you will see that the judges, the registry, and the prosecutor, and the office of the prosecutor, they are housed in the same building. And the prosecutors and the judges are serviced by the same administration, the registry. So his point is, well, there is no separation. He said, I don't like this mixing of judges and prosecutors. And so therefore, in a way, judges may be polluted, contaminated by their daily contact with the prosecutor. Now, my response is that, first of all, this is based on a sort of narrow approach, the approach taken here in this country and in common law countries. If you go to France or to Germany, you may realize that prosecutors and judges, they talk to each other. They say hello to each other. They even have lunch or dinner together. But judges continue to be absolutely independent. So this is part of the culture in other countries, whereas in your culture, it is unacceptable for a prosecutor to talk to a judge and vice versa. But again, this has to do with legal culture. And I would say also that even in The Hague, where people tend to be more, in a way, free in their contacts with the prosecutor, judges with the prosecutor, judges have shown on many occasions they are fully free. Say, for instance, we have an ex parte proceeding when the prosecutor has prepared the indictment against, which may be very often a secret indictment, against a particular suspect. Now, the indictment must be taken to a judge. The judge has to go through the indictment, which is, say, 30 pages, plus a lot of files of supporting material, the evidence. He goes through all that and then must say it is sufficient as a sort of prima facie evidence of a crime, or no, it is not sufficient. So we call this the confirmation or the information of the indictment. Now, this is done ex parte, namely not in the presence, by the judge, with the prosecutor, without a defense counsel. All right. But this is videotaped, is formal, and happens in the presence of some legal officers belonging to the registry who are neutral and watch that there's no impropriety. So therefore, you see, there are a lot of things. One more thing. No judge is allowed to go and talk to the prosecutors, to the three floors belonging to the prosecutor office. The only person who has a special gadget allowing him or her to go and talk to the chief prosecutor is the president. All the other ones cannot simply get into those three corridors. You see, again, there are therefore devices to make sure that there is no contact. And another accusation made by Mr. Robertson relates in particular to the president, and in particular to me when I was president. Now, I don't want to take issue with him only because it's about me. But I want to talk about that only to show the unique features of an international tribunal. I think it is wrong to do what Mr. Robertson does, and many people do, namely to simply transpose onto the international level the model of national courts, national prosecutors, and so on. The model of the administration justice taking place at the national level. You can't apply the same sort of mentality. Mr. Robertson points out, and he's right, what he says is factually absolutely right, that in February 95, he says, Mr. Cassese actually, well, all the judges adopted a declaration criticizing the prosecutorial strategy of the then prosecutor, Mr. Goldstone, from South Africa. And of course, he said, it's unheard of that judges dare to attack the policy devised by the prosecutor. In the UK, a judge would never do so. In my country, a judge would be immediately brought to court for a breach of law. Now, what happened in The Hague was that at one point the judges felt that the policy followed by Mr. Goldstone was simply what he called the pyramidal approach. He said, I will start, 95, by searching for evidence and indicting the small fry. And then gradually I will go up to the pyramid and reach the summit. So the top of the pyramid, namely the political and military leaders. So, and I said, when I met him once, because I was allowed to go into his office because I had this particular magnetic car. And I said, look, I mean, that means that we will reach the Milosevic, Karadzic, Mladic, Tudjman, Izetbegovic in probably 50 years. By the time you arrest all the small fry, and I said, well, I'm not happy about that. He said, well, it is your business. All right. So I summoned, we had a plenary meeting of all judges. I set forth my opinion, and all judges adopted a declaration saying that to our mind, the Security Council, the UN Security Council, has set up this tribunal not for the purpose of replacing national courts, but only which may deal with the small fry, with the small perpetrator, but for the purpose of prosecuting and bringing to trial the leaders. So we said we are not happy with that. Now, as a result, then I said, as a matter of courtesy, I told my fellow judges I should show this harsh declaration adopted unanimously by all judges, including prominent judges from Australia, Sir Ninian Stephen, I mean, who is a wonderful judge, judges from Nigeria, from Malaysia, from common law countries, who were not so upset by this move. And in the event, I told, look, as a matter of courtesy, I should show this declaration to Mr. Goldstone. And Mr. Goldstone, who is a very skillful politician and extremely clever man, said, well, if you change one or two words, I can subscribe to this declaration. This was in February 95. In July 95, he issued an important indictment against Karadzic and Mladic. So I think we were not wrong. But it's open for you to decide whether we were wrong as judges in a way to trespass on the powers of the prosecutor. But why? Because this was a unique international criminal tribunal where you cannot stick to the rules prevailing in the UK, in Italy, in France, and so on. Another point was made by Mr. Robertson that in June 96, and he's right, there was a huge conference of foreign ministers dealing with former Yugoslavia, and I made a speech as president of the tribunal saying, look, it was June 96. Mr. Karadzic, Mr. Mladic are top indictees. Arrest warrants have been issued against them through Interpol, so they can't move out of Serbia or Bosnia-Herzegovina. This is not enough. You people from NATO countries, you've got to arrest them and to or to issue sanctions against them. And I even suggested a particular sanction, namely to suspend Serbia from the Olympic Games. And many countries, including, of course, the US, were terribly upset, said this is not for a president of a tribunal to suggest sanctions. And this point has been taken up by Ms. Robertson. Again, I think this was done by a president of a tribunal who was not acting as an impartial judge. He was acting as a man who had to make sure that those who had been accused by the prosecutor with an arrest warrant issued by a judge should be brought to trial. Now, you don't need to do so in the UK. In the UK, the president of any UK tribunal has not got to do so. Because why? Because this is a job for the Home Secretary or for the Chief of Prosecution or whatever. Because you have the authorities competent to do so. But if in the international community you are dealing with states which pursue short-term national interests, which are dealing with some leaders, say Milosevic, and then one day they accept that he should be incriminated, then it is for the president of an international criminal tribunal to speak out and to say, look, we are not happy with it. So this is, small point. I know that I'm running short of time, but Serbia now is accusing including, as you know, President Kostunica, accusing the tribunal of being anti-Serbian, of being biased. Why? And he cites, among other things, the decision of the present prosecutor, Mrs. Carla Del Ponte, not to indict, not even to start investigations against, say, NATO forces, the pilots who blew up the bridge, the famous bridge, who shelled some television installations, bridges, and so on, and killed a lot of civilians. Now, but I think President Kostunica is wrong in speaking against the tribunal, because the tribunal consists of three different bodies: the prosecutor, the registry, and the judges. The judges are absolutely independent, absolutely impartial. It is for the prosecutor to decide whether or not prosecute members of NATO forces. So therefore, I would say Mr. Kostunica should attack, if he is prepared to do so, he should attack the prosecutor. And I myself have some doubts. If I were in the shoes of the prosecutor, I would have started investigations. But this is my personal view, not as a former judge, but as a professor of international law, who knows something about humanitarian law and the laws of warfare. Now, let me just end with one point. Again, to go back to Mr. Kostunica. Mr. Kostunica recently, a few days ago, he said, look, I don't like this Hague Tribunal. They are not impartial. I will set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now, let us ask ourselves together, on what conditions, whether this is a good move, or on what conditions such a commission may be found acceptable by the international community. I would say that this is not a bad view, not a bad proposal by Mr. Kostunica, President Kostunica. However, I strongly feel, again, this is my personal opinion, I don't know what the present president of the tribunal, Judge Jorda from France, would feel about my view. I would say that this could be acceptable on some very clear conditions. First of all, I would say this Truth and Reconciliation Commission to be set up in Belgrade should only deal with the executioners, not with the political and military leaders, the small fry, the middle-level perpetrators of crimes, not with Milosevic and so on. The leaders, the political and military leaders, should be tried in The Hague by the International Tribunal. Second, this commission should be authorized to give amnesty only to those who have not committed mass atrocities, mass rapes, for instance, mass killing of civilians. In other words, they should be granted pardon, if any, only for war crimes, not for genocide or crimes against humanity. Third, to my mind, this commission should be empowered to pardon only those who have war criminals who not only have disclosed their own crimes, as it happened in South Africa, but have also report fully on crimes perpetrated by other people, particularly crimes committed at the higher level. And fourth, the commission should fully cooperate with the Hague Tribunal. In other words, this should not be an alternative to the Hague Tribunal, but should go hand in hand with this tribunal. Now, one final word to sum up. I think that, and I would like, if there is any question on this matter, to mention a recent case which will be decided upon by the International Court of Justice next Monday, today a week, in The Hague. A very interesting case brought by a Belgian judge against the foreign minister of Congo for atrocities committed in the Congo. If you are interested, I can say a few words about that case. My conclusion is that, to sum up my modest reflections, is that we may not choose one option, namely just international criminal courts. I think we should go for three possible options: international criminal courts, national courts, and possibly the establishment of good, effective truth and reconciliation commissions. There should not be alternative solutions. They should be used together, and they may only be the only and the by far the best means, since the Security Council is so impotent, since the UN cannot cope with huge atrocities, is a sort of combined and strong reaction to the unbearable misdeeds we are obliged to witness every day in the world, with a deep sense, at least in my case, also in your case, I think, of dismay and frustration. Thank you so much.
Well, I think you'll agree, very powerful lecture. Certain amount of time for discussion only. There should be, I think, microphones around the room. Yeah upstairs as well. Can I ask those who want to ask questions just to limit themselves to one question, please, and ask it as directly and shortly as possible.
Should I respond at the end to all questions or one by one?
One by one. Start with another one.
Professor Cassese, my name is John Lachland. You mentioned some technical problems that the International Criminal Tribunal has to face, but I think the real problems are surely ones of legitimacy. People have accused you of double standards and of being the instrument of the great powers and so on. I assume that your reply to these questions about legitimacy would be that you are the representative of universal values and that you have a moral legitimacy to prosecute and convict people for infringing those universal values. In that context, I'd like to ask you, and in your capacity as a professor of humanitarian law, how it is that international humanitarian law, which is supposed to be universal, can change over time. In 1899, in the first Hague conference, which drew up the first modern laws of war, aerial bombardment was illegal. As you know, that is now no longer the case. Aerial bombardment is not now considered to be a war crime. In fact, one could be forgiven for thinking it's considered to be a judicial procedure, given the way that many supporters of international law have supported aerial bombardment in recent years. Could I ask you then whether you support, as a professor and as a private individual with a view on these matters, do you support the fact that this has now been dropped as a crime? And why do you think that was done?
Well, I would say that, first of all, on the question of double standard, I agree with you. I'm afraid it's true that what is one of the charges moved by Belgrade and even President Kostunica, that we dispense selective justice. Why Yugoslavia? Why Rwanda? Why Sierra Leone and not say other countries where, why not Chechnya? In Chechnya, the horrendous crimes are being committed. But of course, Chechnya is part of Russia, and Russia is a permanent member of the Security Council. It is true, this is selective justice. I'm afraid we knew from the outset that we were proceeding on this assumption, that we would deal only with some of crimes committed in particular area of the world. That's why I am strongly in favor of the International Criminal Court, which will have universal jurisdiction, and I hope even over US servicemen who commit crimes on the territory of states parties. I think this is very important. I think the US opposition is very bad. Now, so therefore, I'm fully aware of the weaknesses, of the flaws of this international criminal justice. But you must proceed step by step. And the next step, the crucial step, is the establishment of a strong international criminal court. Now, the question of aerial bombardment. Aerial bombardment, I think, was, I didn't understand you correctly. I don't think aerial bombardment was illegal. Aerial bombardment was not known. There were balloons, and actually, as you know, the airplanes were used for the first time by Italy in Libya when in the Italy-Libya war in 1910, and then of course in Spain by the Germans in the civil war in Spain 36-39. And then, of course, the First World War, and then Spain, sorry. Now, aerial bombardment from the outset was not illegal as such. What was illegal was the killing of civilians, what now we call the collateral damage to civilians. Aerial bombardment, as I say, was not, we can dispute, we can discuss this matter, but as such, it was just a new weapon. States, I'm afraid, major powers are reluctant to prohibit methods or means of warfare which prove effective. They've never prohibited, nuclear weapons. They prohibited dum-dum bullets because gradually they became of less importance. Napalm has been prohibited only to some extent. And so on. But what is now prohibited is, as I say, the causing of collateral damage to civilians through the use of any means of warfare. This is the crucial problem. I think today there are two crucial problems in the laws of warfare. First of all, the huge expansion of the notion of military objective. If you think what NATO has done in Kosovo. Now, for NATO, almost everything was a military objective, a legitimate military objective. There we have to contest what they've done. Everything, and even radio, TV installations. Only hospitals, of course, provided they don't conceal guns or weapons and so on. Hospitals and museums, works of art, and so on are not military objectives. Otherwise, everything has become a military objective. The second crucial point is the notion of collateral damage. If you look up the rules which you can find in the first Geneva Protocol of 1974, you find very loose language. I was there in Geneva when these provisions were drafted. And of course, these provisions were drafted by the Soviet Union and the US with France and the UK. They, of course, these are the powerful countries which decided, let us leave these provisions as vague as possible so that we don't tie our hands. And if you look up, I'm afraid to say, some provisions of the statute of the International Criminal Court, there is even one word which has worsened the notion of collateral damage. So therefore, gradually, major powers are trying to broaden the notion of collateral damage. This is the crucial. But as I say, aerial warfare has always been allowed to the extent that the civilians were not hit.
Is there a question from upstairs? Just better get the nearest person.
Yes, I would like to draw to your attention, Professor, that the British government...
Just ask one. Is it possible to ask one question to give other people more time?
Yes, this is one question. It has to do with the draft bill that has been published by the British government with regard to incorporating the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court into British domestic law. There are some good things about this draft bill, but I wonder if the professor would have a message for the British government, if he would learn now or perhaps already knows, that the draft bill excludes universal jurisdiction and excludes the state immunities. Would you have a message for the British government on that?
Yeah, of course. I can't say outrageous, but it's really absolutely unacceptable, in particular to exclude immunity, to exclude the exclusion of immunity. Because one of the basic rules of the Rome Statute is the lifting of immunities for any senior state officials who is accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. So it would be, I'm afraid I have not read the draft bill, British draft bill, but I'll do so tomorrow, because right away. And also, I don't understand what you say about universal jurisdiction. You know that the Rome Statute provides that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has jurisdiction over crimes committed on the territory of a contracting party, either by a national of that party or by a foreigner, say somebody belonging to a third country, say an American committing a crime on British territory. Since the UK will be a party to the ICC, this American in principle should be brought to trial before the ICC. Now, I hope that the British authorities have not excluded this possibility. Otherwise, it would be really a major disaster, because this British example would be followed by other countries. Thank you.
Lady at the back there.
Thank you. Following your comment on humanitarian imperialism and the efficacy of weapons, I would like to comment one case. During the Gulf War, the British government and the American government, they used depleted uranium bullets, which are illegal according to humanitarian law because of temporality, because of territoriality, because of dishumanity, and because of the environmental damage they can lead for 4.5 million years. Since then, all the Gulf War syndrome veterans, they are not allowed to be tested. They have been having their houses ransacked here in the States and also in Iraq. So in case this tribunal one day will bring Saddam Hussein to a court for criminal acts, what's the possibility to bring also George Bush and Norman Schwab's corpse, because they deliberately, knowingly decided to bomb nuclear facilities without enough ammunition, knowing they will leave radiation there for billions of years? I lived in the air, so I know. So I would like to know, with the instruments this tribunal has now, in case someone will bring Saddam, for sure needed to be judged, and if the population of Iraq would also try to bring into accountability those who did that.
Yeah, thank you. Of course, I mean, it is, in theory, both Saddam Hussein and the British or American pilots who used those illegal weapons should be brought before the International Criminal Court. The problem is that you can do so only if Iraq ratifies the statute of the ICC, because these were crimes committed either by foreign nationals, say Western pilots or servicemen on Iraqi territory, or by Saddam Hussein on its own territory, his own territory. But so therefore we would need the ratification by Iraq. As long as Iraq does not ratify, and it will never ratify, the court will be utterly impotent. This is the problem. You know, the court, the International Criminal Court, is still based on the notion of state sovereignty. This is the big issue.
Why did you have the question?
I didn't.
Sorry, I can't hear what you're saying.
Kuwait is also contaminated, but cannot declare because then the Americans will be upset and will take the troops out. What if Kuwait goes for it and say, well, we've been also contaminated by depleted uranium and we want to...
Yeah, good. But again, this, of course, presupposes the ratification by Kuwait of the statute of the ICC. And I very much hope that at least Kuwait will ratify the statute, which is an international treaty.
Do you have another question from upstairs? I don't know if the mic can get right away across there.
Thank you very much. You said that the current president of Yugoslavia had accused your tribunal of selective justice. It seemed to me that he's completely right. You mentioned all sorts of people indicted. All of them, their names ended in Vich or Itch or something like that. There was nobody called Blair or Clinton or a similar name. Now, recently, as you probably know, the British House of Commons investigated the legality of the bombing campaign, and many well-known British international lawyers gave evidence, and almost all of them, not all of them, but they were exceptions, but the majority of them said it was illegal, the bombing campaign. And given that, and given the fact that your tribunal has not indicted anybody, as far as I know, from NATO, previously you said, well, that's all the fault of the prosecutors. But we know you're quite happy to criticize the prosecutors. Why didn't you make a similar statement criticizing them for their one-sided justice?
Well, first of all, of course, the bombing campaign was against international law, the attack by NATO on Kosovo, both because it was a grave breach of the UN Charter, because the attack was not authorized by the Security Council, and because, to the best of my knowledge, NATO forces breached repeatedly some fundamental provisions of humanitarian law. Now, the prosecutor has, as you may know, issued a report, has received a report prepared by a committee of legal officers set up by her, actually by the previous prosecutor, Arbour, and she has endorsed that report, which is public. It's on the internet, on the website. I read this report. By that time, I had already stepped down as a judge, and I took part in a public discussion in Geneva a few months ago in June with the prosecutor, Carla Del Ponte. And in so many words, I said, Carla, I totally disagree with you and with your legal officers. I think this report is wrong, and you should not have based yourself on the legal conclusions of your people, which remind me of some American and British claims about the legality or illegality of the attack on Kosovo. This was the only thing I could do. The current judges of the International Criminal Tribunal, there are 14 judges, have decided not to take any action. I think they're right, because this is not this is a policy choice which is totally different from the one taken by Goldstone, the one I quoted before. That one was not one against one particular indictee, but against the level of accused. Small fry versus the lead top leaders. Now, in this case, it's not this sort of choice. The choice is whether or not to indict servicemen belonging to the US, Italy, UK, France, and so on. And I think the judges are quite right in not taking any position on this particular decision taken by Mrs. Del Ponte. So you can't ask too much from the judges. The judges must be absolutely independent. Of course, privately, they can express their misgivings, their doubts, their perplexities. And we, the people who have no longer any official status, we can say we don't agree. I, for one, as I say, I strongly disagreed in public with Carla Del Ponte.
I'm really sorry. We've only got time for one more question. I do apologize to all the people who want to ask questions. I think I have to take one from over here because no one's had a chance from that side of the room downstairs.
Thank you. Simon Burrell from Charter 99. Douglas Hurd, former Foreign Secretary, Conservative, wrote an article in The Times a couple of months ago saying that he felt that the International Criminal Court would actually get in the way of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. And I thought after your summing up, when you said that you thought the three of them would work together, I just wondered what your response to him would be and how you see Truth and Reconciliation working with international justice in that way.
Well, I think I've never read his statement, but probably as most diplomats and politicians, he was in favor of a truth and reconciliation commission of the Latin American kind, where you have no real justice, and people go scot-free, they are pardoned, they may admit some crimes, that's all. And for politicians and diplomats, it's much better. Politicians got terribly upset when Mr. Milosevic was indicted because, of course, this complicates their life. Whereas in my case, what I'm suggesting is that if Kostunica goes ahead with his proposal, he should do so only subject to very stringent conditions, the four conditions I set out before, which means that he has to cooperate with the Hague Tribunal, and in particular, he has to arrest and hand over Milosevic, Karadzic, Mladic, and so on, and the top people to the Hague Tribunal. And then he can deal with all the perpetrators. There are many. You know, there are probably up to, according to the former prosecutor, up to 200,000 people have committed crime in the former Yugoslavia. Imagine a huge amount of crimes committed, from, say, one or two rapes to large-scale mass rape, to killing, ethnic cleansing, expulsion, persecution, torture, a lot of cases of torture, and so on. So some of these cases may be handled by national courts or by the National Yugoslav Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but they are not able to conduct a fair trial against Mr. Milosevic. Of course, no country would be able to conduct a fair trial against the top leader who has been in power for so many years.
Can I ask the audience to thank again Professor Kosesi for his incisive lecture?